This is the 3D Pod, your number one source for 3D printing news, analysis, and insight from 3DPrint.com. Now, here are your hosts, Joris Peels and Maxwell Bogue.
Hi, everyone. My name is Joris Peels, and this is another episode of the 3D Pod. And with me, as always, is Maxwell Bogue. How are you doing, Max?
Hey, Joris. How are you doing? I'm good. Yourself?
I'm great. Doing really well. You looking forward to the show today?
Yeah, I know you just got back from New York, but it was good to see you in person for a brief shining moment. But who do we have on the 3D Pod today to have fun with?
Yeah, sure. We got Amy Alexander. So she's the unit head of the mechanical development and applied computational engineering at the Mayo Clinic, the world famous hospital that invented mayonnaise in 1868. No, of course. She is a world famous hospital, of course, the Mayo Clinic, which is like, really breakthrough hospital. There's a lot of really cutting edge clinical stuff. And she is really in charge of, some of the things of taking 2D to turning into useful 3D products. She's also a past chair of some standards organizations and some industry organizations like SME, Medical and Manufacturing Technical Advisory Board. She's also in the Radiological Society of North America's 3D Special Interest Groups, which is a wonderful group that has done a ton of work to make sure that radiologists are at the forefront of all doctors, really, in understanding 3D printing and understanding how they can harness this technology. So, yeah, it's absolutely a pleasure to have Amy here today. So welcome to the show, Amy.
Thank you so much. Thanks for the invitation. Happy to be here.
So first off, I think one thing I want to start with before we start is you're actually an engineer, right? Medical engineer. And, it just seems to me that given 3D printing, but also like AI and software and all that, we're going to need a lot more engineers in medicine, right?
Oh, absolutely. Workforce development is a huge part of the field, and it's a big missing chunk of the field at this time. We are definitely encouraging young people to pursue engineering and to pursue these cutting edge technologies in their training.
Do they need to have a biological focus in their engineering, or
necessarily?
Okay.
No. So engineers are taught to learn. Engineers are taught to solve problems. And one of the things that we look for is an eagerness to approach a problem with an open mind, figure out what the user needs are, and then develop the products so that we can meet those clinical needs by utilizing the manufacturing technologies and other technologies that we have available at our fingertips.
Okay, so, that sounds really cool. Where is the need the highest? Like, where are you saying, like, oh my God, if I had people like that, I would hire them straight away? Like, what kind of areas is the need really the highest?
Designing for additive manufacturing, designing for traditional manufacturing, and understanding the differences in selecting a material that meets the needs of the product. So we end up training folks to understand the physiology and anatomy. That's all just learning. So you can learn those things on the job. You can learn them with each new project. We have a number of projects in the queue right now that require some understanding of anatomy and physiology, but you don't need to go into the field with a full biology or biological background. We are looking for designers. We are looking for engineers who leverage computer-aided design and computer-aided manufacturing.
Okay, that's super cool. And then, of course, as the case of working for the Mayo Clinic, that seems, I don't know, it's one of the most prestigious, well-known hospitals in the world, right? I mean, that's why I think a lot of people would be drawn there. Or
it's like the Ferrari of a hospital.
So we're known as a destination medical center. A lot of local businesses utilize the quote Med City. You know, there's like Med City Cab and Med City Burritos and Med City newspaper articles that come out that are always talking about how our focus as a city is on helping people. And it really rings true. There's a thread of compassion kind of throughout the community. And, you know, Mayo Clinic employs about 70,000 people across the enterprise, which isn't just in Rochester, Minnesota. We also have major sites in Scottsdale and Phoenix, Arizona, and in Jacksonville, Florida, as well as our health system sites, which is across the three states of Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Iowa. But Rochester, Minnesota is the birthplace of Mayo Clinic, and it was started by the Mayo brothers in the late 1800s in response to a tornado that wiped out a lot of the city, a lot of the infrastructure, and of course, injured many of the city's inhabitants. And the Sisters of Francis, St. Francis of Assisi, were the ones who encouraged the two young Mayo brothers to initiate a hospital system in the middle of the cornfields, kind of in the middle of nowhere in southeastern Minnesota. So we are a destination medical center, and that means that we treat patients from across the globe. If you go to the Mayo Clinic website, there are statistics about how many countries we have served patients from and how far they travel. One of the things that we pride ourselves on is speed. So having an in-house additive manufacturing infrastructure here, an ecosystem here, is really important, because if we were to outsource everything that we did for our patients and everything that we did for clinical care, we would be expanding those timelines. For example, you know, a patient may come from the country of Jordan, and we need to treat this patient in the duration of time that they have planned for their visit. Otherwise, they need to travel home and travel back, and there's a lot of travel expenses incurred. Some people are traveling on their last dime, and so we really want to be able to see them, image them, turn around whatever devices that are needed to individualize their surgery all in the same week. That is the goal, is to treat patients the same week that they are seen in the hospital.
Okay. And if you look at what kind of printers and stuff do you guys have in-house then? What kind of machinery do you have and software and stuff?
So we have a couple of different additive manufacturing centers. The one that I used to work in is in the Department of Radiology. It's called the Anatomic Modeling Unit. And the AMU is what it's called, houses five different printing technologies: material extrusion, vat photopolymerization, powder bed fusion, and a number of others. And they're used in response, they're purchased in response to the need from the clinicians. So the physicians may say, you know, I really need something that's got some give and some flexibility, but also some durability. And so it makes sense then to print in, say, a nylon 12. Or they need something that can be made biocompatible, you know, that could be made to utilize biocompatible materials on a vat photopolymerization printer. Or they need it extremely fast, and then we can utilize some digital light processing from VP. And that's the Department of Radiology. Their whole job is to intake requests from clinicians in real time for patients that are actively being treated, and then turn around anatomic models and surgical guides to help the patients understand their own procedure and help the surgeons plan for the procedure and then help the surgeons execute the procedure. Now, I'm in the Division of Engineering. I transferred over into a leadership role here about 3 years ago. And we have an additive manufacturing facility inside a hospital building. And we have a titanium powder bed fusion printer, as well as a number of polymer printers that utilize material extrusion and vat photopolymerization. Some of these are used mainly for prototyping medical devices that, you know, are the invention of the physicians that we work with. And some of them are used for end part fabrication. It really just depends on the use case. And that is captured in a full design control cycle where we understand user needs. We look at verification specifications. We figure out our validation plans. We do a safety review and analysis. And then all materials are selected based on the end part usage.
So you guys go way beyond, just prototyping devices for surgical planning and stuff like that. So talk to me a little bit about that invention part. That, you know, does a surgeon come to you and say, "Hey, I have a problem. How does that get started?"
That's exactly how it happened. So I'll go back about 100 years. In 1915, the Mayo brothers initiated an instrument shop where they had welders and fabricators from the community come in and help them to fabricate device ideas for surgery. It starts with a napkin sketch. It really does. It starts with an idea for improvement of the procedure. And today, we've grown from an instrument shop to a full-fledged division of engineering that houses software engineers, computer engineers, electrical engineers, biomedical engineers, mechanical engineers, aerospace engineers, because there is a field of medicine called aerospace medicine, and systems engineers. And our entire division is made up of engineers, designers, and technicians who can listen to the physician, listen to them talk about the problem that they have. They're on site. We're shoulder to shoulder. So we go into the operating room and we see the problem firsthand. And that's part of our investigation procedure. Then we come back and we write down all of the different user needs. So, you know, maybe the physician needs a new shape of scalpel for a septomyectomy. That's a part of the heart, that muscle that needs to be taken out because it's overgrown. You know, the surgeon has an idea. They draw it. They physically draw it on a piece of paper, and then they can scan it in, send it in with their digital request to us. We initiate the process of going out and seeing the procedure and understanding the pain points and where these bottlenecks are happening, where time is being consumed, because one of the most important aspects of surgery is limiting the amount of time that the patients are under anesthesia, because it generally reduces risk. And so we are always looking to shorten the surgery time. They come to us with this idea on a napkin. We figure out the problem, and then we have a brainstorming session between technicians, because they know the manufacturing equipment. They know the capabilities and limitations of the different machinery that we have on site. And they also very deeply understand the materials and the physics of those materials, the mechanics of those materials, and what the materials can or can't accomplish if we were to choose them for the final device. Then we have the designers. The designers are either industrial designers, computer-aided designers. They come in and mock things up in, say, SolidWorks or another 3D modeling software. And then those images and those designs in 3D are shared with the surgeon. Usually they're surgeons, but they can be practitioners of any kind. And then there's this, a constant feedback loop and constant iteration until we get to the point of prototyping the device. And that's where additive manufacturing really shines. Obviously, we're greatly familiar with the benefits of additive, you know, geometric freedom, iteration speed, material selection opportunities. And so we kind of just get closer and closer to the final part. And then at the end, when we freeze the design and we have controlled the entire design process from start to finish, we will deliver the product. And if it's something that's going into surgery, we will include instructions for reprocessing, or what that means in medical terms is the cleaning and the sterilization of the device that is needed to happen in order for it to be compatible with the surgery.
Are you guys ever making things that you're implanting in people? And then
that is a
great question. Is there a whole regulatory thing behind that on top of it?
Yes, absolutely. So do we fabricate via additive things that are implanted today? No. We are about 3 years into a 5-year project to utilize our titanium powder bed fusion printer to fabricate patient matched surgical implants on demand. So what that means is I was talking about the 1-week turnaround, right? And how important it is for us to value the patient's time and money as an institution. And what we see is the ability to see a patient on a Monday and have a CT scan done, have that imaging converted into an anatomic model, have the surgeon digitally reconstruct the patient's anatomy in 3D space. That's all done by the anatomic modeling unit. And the anatomic modeling unit can also 3D print, well, design and then 3D print surgical guides to carry out the reconstruction plan of the surgery. So essentially, think of it as a carpentry a little bit. You're 3D printing jigs that will fit to the patient's bones in one location and only in one location due to the fiducial markings and things that that adhere the guide to the patient's bones. And it only works on that patient. So it is truly individualized medicine. And then the bone saws are guided through, or the screw trajectories are guided, and the surgeon can reconstruct the bones. But the next step is to plate those bones in place. And so once the reconstruction is done digitally, those files are shared with the Division of Engineering, and our engineers and designers will use scripting capabilities to design the plate in 3D space and then manufacture via powder bed fusion. There are a whole range of post-processing techniques that need to be done once the print is finished. And then we provide that to the surgical core so that they can clean and sterilize the plate and it can be used to finalize the reconstruction of the patient.
Okay. Well, so, that's really cutting edge stuff because yeah. like we see exactly. The HSS is always the example because they have a Ducento
yep.
kind of production facility, but they, it's run by Ducento at their site, right? So they're kind of like offloading the day-to-day managing of that site
right.
to them. Then we also have, of course, the guys at the VA who are doing it, but they're a gigantic system, a huge, huge medical system, many, many billions of dollars, and they'd like to mm-hmm. they have the ability to really experiment. So that's one thing. But you guys are doing it, you know, in a much more kind of like a very, very different environment. Like given the, you know, HSS does like tens of thousands of the same procedures. You guys are doing a lot of variable stuff, right?
That's right. So because we are a destination medical center, people that we see, the patients that we see are coming to us as a last resort. They're either coming to us as a last resort or they're coming to us with a very, very complex problem. So what we're looking at is not mass production at all. We are looking at individualized medicine at the most minute scale. We're looking at one patient at a time and understanding, can an off-the-shelf implant be used? If so, great. Use an off-the-shelf implant. Use a commercial implant or a serial implant is what we call it. And serial, for those who don't think of it this way, sometimes we think of it as like t-shirt sizes, small, medium, large. But if you think of the size of the human population and you think maybe Mother Teresa to Shaquille O'Neal, you can't really put them into only three categories of hip implants, small, medium, large. There is an opportunity to individualize the implant and design it specifically for the patient based on their own imaging, especially if they've had surgeries before in that area and they need a revision surgery performed, or if they've had bone degeneration from cancer or other ailments. So it's a very niche market, and in no way are we competing with, you know, the big medical device manufacturers. We are simply trying to fill a need that is there for patients that come to Mayo Clinic as a last resort.
Given okay. that you guys do deal almost exclusively in edge cases, so to speak, I guess, are you finding it that you need to develop obviously a process in order to get certification so that you can put something in someone's body? But is that process going to be flexible enough so that you can almost make a part that you didn't realize you needed a week earlier for, you know, let's be really crazy. Like if you had to bioprint like a valve for a heart in a new way that just, it's the only way it could work. Is that in your vision of the future? Do you think that's something that you guys could do where you can have it certified, the process, I guess, certified so that you're able to then make a one-off, never going to be used again, custom part that can be put into a person?
Great question. So what we focus on is controlling every single aspect of the process that we can control, locking it down, and then allowing for the variability only when needed. So it's exactly what you're talking about.
Right.
The entire process is validated And so we lock down every single step that we take in standard operating procedures, work instructions, and then we use forms to handle the variability. So what is our input data? That's going to be the CT scan and the reconstructed digital three-dimensional parts of the patient. And then the output is also going to be variable depending on the user needs. So for every single case, we still follow extreme design controls. I don't know if extreme is the right word, but very, very constricted design controls. And that helps us to feel confident in the safety and efficacy of the output.
I love the idea. Like, I really see this as like for trauma, onco, like this is really, really great with these really, really very difficult cases with oncology and stuff like that. But, you know, guides, I think with a polymer powder bed fusion machine to make the guides would be fairly doable. But if you're willing to turn around a unique implant on a metal implant in a week, that's going to be really tight in my estimation. Just, you know, and I don't even know anything about the putting it in the body thing.
Right.
It's an absolute stretch goal. So we do not deal with mediocrity. We are looking to excel, right? And so a stretch goal would be to see the patient on a Monday and have a surgery on a Friday with a patient-matched implant. At first, when we get started and we fully validated our process and all of our procedures are completely controlled and we take our first case, we're probably looking at like a 3-week turnaround just because we are not fully.
That's still very impressive.
Well, we're not really understanding all the bottlenecks that can happen until we stress test the system. So we're interested in that. We do some systems engineering, like spaghetti diagrams of, okay, the designers are doing this and then the technicians are taking it over here and walking 20 steps to the printer to hit start button. And then there's the annealing process in the oven. And then there's the removal of the parts using wire EDM. There's passivation that happens in a lab around the corner. How many steps are we taking to do that? But none of it is trivial. However, none of it is unknown. This is not something that we are doing as the first group to ever do it. 3D printed implants are everywhere in the market. So we didn't invent the idea. We are trying to bring it into the hospital and do it on demand in very specific ways.
Okay, that's really exciting. And then if you're talking about this, then of course, I like the idea that I think it's realistic seeing this as a stretch goal and stuff like that. But then, then it's a really difficult discussion, I think, to you know, this is a significant investment. I mean, this is not, they're talking several million dollars, like, you know.
Yep.
So this was like something that and was it really that time thing that really pushed the needle? Was it like, yeah, we needed to do that turnaround time for the
turnaround
patient?
Time is by far the number one request that we have, the number one push. Turnaround time and individualization. So for example, we had a case a couple of years ago and we were not prepared to do in-house printing on demand for surgical use of our printed guides or our printed implants, excuse me. We had to outsource it. It took 16 months.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah.
That is not an acceptable turnaround time for us. That patient was very unhappy. They were in a lot of pain. There was really nothing that could be done except, you know, design and fabricate a very unique patient implant. And this poor patient had to wait 16 months for that to happen. Now they're doing great with the outsourced implant. They're doing very, very well. They have full functionality and everything. But 16 months is really unacceptable for us.
Well, then, of course, it comes down to your technology choice, right? There's powder bed fusion. We've got E-beam, and then we've got laser powder bed fusion.
Face.
Like, why did you choose one over the other?
Yep. So there was a full market analysis done prior to my moving over into the division. And the most common, we chose the most common and the most reputable of technologies to use for our implant fabrication. We have recognized since then that, you know, things grow and technology advances, technology changes. And, you know, in 5-10 years, maybe maybe the whole commercial side of things will be using a different material. But we know that this is tried and true. We know that the grade 23 TI6AL4V ELI powder is going to give us the results that we need. And we understand the process from hitting the print button to delivering it to the OR. And so there were very few unknowns, whereas if we were to choose E-beam or, you know, a different technology and a totally different material, there were a lot more unknowns that we would have to develop answers to. And that wasn't of interest at the time. We wanted to pick the lowest hanging fruit and move forward with something that we knew was already being very successful commercially, and just bring it inside the hospital.
And then another thing is what you touched on briefly, it was like this making of surgical instrumentation, because that's something that never gets talked about because we don't have enough examples. Right? Mm. Because you said this like custom scalpel thing. I know I've done certain things in relation to this, but can you share some more examples of this like kind of unique instrumentation you've been doing?
Oh, yes. And I have also been coached not to share a lot of examples, but we can think about it's mostly because when we do come up with a new device idea, we work very closely with the group at Mayo Clinic Ventures. And that's a side of the business that is interested in patenting and potentially licensing out the technology to a commercial entity. But I can think of some examples here. I was talking about septal myectomy. Septal myectomy is a procedure where when the heart muscle overgrows in a certain location, there is a need to remove it so that the heart can function better. That's about as simply as I can explain that. The technologies on the market are good and do the thing that needs to be done, but they're not great. And maybe they don't include some of the other surgical technologies, like a good way of viewing what you're doing when you go in to do that. So like a scope, a video feed, and they don't have great ways of lighting that. So it's possible that if we incorporate a scope and a lighting element to an existing technology, we are improving the surgical outcomes. And so that's kind of an example of something that we would take on.
Is there anything that's come out of the venture wing at this point?
Is there anything that's come out of ventures? Almost
public
everything.
And that you can discuss. Well, yeah, no. I just mean,
yeah.
Is there a good example that you can point to that's come out of the venture side as a result of going through this whole process?
Sure.
Years to get through all of this, but like, yeah. I don't know if there's anything that came out of the additive endeavors that then now have been commercialized, productized, and then shipped out to other hospitals, essentially.
Well, I'll talk briefly about Mayo Clinic's employee entrepreneur program. So physicians who are interested in commercializing their technology and then having it licensed to their own company can embark on this program and create a company, and then Mayo Clinic will license the tech to that company. And so there is such a company called Navinetics, and Navinetics does deep brain stimulation and sensing. And what that is really for patients with epilepsy or other seizures, and localizing and understanding the exact location in the brain that there's activity when a seizure is occurring, and then treating that portion of the brain either through a resection, so taking it out, or other means of disabling that brain tissue so that the seizures do not continue. So Navinetics is a company that was started by Dr. Kendall Lee and Dr. Kevin Bennett. Dr. Kevin Bennett is the former chair of the Division of Engineering and still a Mayo Clinic employee, but also a founder of Navinetics. And the technology that was brought as an initial idea, I'm going to say 10 plus years ago, to the division, was then developed for stereotactic head framing and being able to isolate the exact location where the needle needs to go to do the thing that needs to be done in the brain. that is something that came out of Division of Engineering, was then licensed by MCV to Navonetics, and is now patented, and they have a 510K for their technology.
And then another thing that I think is really exciting, I think, and that's also something that has been going on, a lot, not a lot of people talk about it. It's like things like trays and packaging, right? Mm. If we're looking at a very complicated surgery, we're talking custom implants or instruments, you know, somebody has to, you know, put it in the patient in the right order, right? And we need, and like custom trays. Do you do a lot of stuff in that kind of, in that way as well, like custom trays or custom packaging type stuff?
That might be something that we embark on. Really, it just depends on the problem that they bring to our attention. You know, if the problem is figuring out the order in which the surgical instruments are used and further identification or labeling on those is required, that could be something that we take on. But that's also very, it's going to be a universal problem. And so you're probably going to see something on the commercial market. One thing that we do at the beginning of every single investigation is evaluate what's commercially available. We are not in the business of designing and fabricating tooling that could be purchased through a commercial partner. So that's a point that I want to make. We are really filling gaps that cannot be filled anywhere else. And we're looking at, you know, using a risk-based approach and the tools that we have to connect the technology to the need of the physician.
And how about on the polymer side? I mean, I think, you know, you talked about PA12, we use PA12 in the body to a certain extent as well, you know, where titanium pretty much works for a lot of the stuff we want to do right now. And the polymer side, I think we're really kind of being held back a little bit more by materials.
Yeah. So, you know, material advancements have skyrocketed in terms of, materials that can be produced to make a part that can be made biocompatible. And I say it in that ridiculous roundabout fashion because there is no such thing as a biocompatible material. There is such a thing as a material that can be utilized in a very specific design that is produced very, very intentionally and then cleaned, post-processed, cleaned, and then sterilized, and then the part itself, the geometry itself can be called biocompatible. And there has been an explosion of material development in that realm. And we're hopeful that that will continue because we are still struggling. You know, they've met the needs of biocompatibility in a lot of ways, but what we're focusing now on is mechanical properties and understanding the amount of force and stress and mechanical torque and things like that that the part can actually withstand without causing harm to the patient. And that's where I'm hoping that material development keeps going. You know, there's additively produced silicone now, and silicone is notorious for being, you know, health focused and food safe and that sort of thing. So that's going to be a big area that we look into for developing prototypes as well.
What about for when you do get to the point where you're making implantable things?
Yeah.
Are you guys considering also like, you know, like PCL, for example, which was, you know, can degrade in the human body?
So that is a very exciting field that is outside the realm of the scope of our capabilities at this time. And that is really rooted in research. Mayo Clinic does a lot of bioprinting research, and there are IRB studies where patients are receiving bioprinted implants on the horizon. But right now, what I know is that there are large animal studies to confirm and verify and then validate these bioprinted materials. So that's a very exciting field as well.
Now we're getting into the cute / I can ride it kind of area. Yeah. So that's ongoing. I'm a huge fan of PCL. So that's a huge development, I think, as well. And then another thing that I think if we're talking about these polymers is like PEEK and PEEK, and these are other materials that are sterilizable, very tough, couldn't exhibit good biocompatibility. Your school's a little bit on our language.
I love how you said that.
Are you enthusiastic about those materials as well? Or
yes. Yep. So we, you know, Mayo Clinic is like its own government, and you can't just decide one day that you want to buy a new $100,000 piece of equipment. But you can plan for it about a year in advance. And so we do have a plan to incorporate likely peak powder bed fusion into our additive manufacturing facility in the next year. We're currently undergoing a massive renovation that includes both our additive manufacturing facility and our microfabrication laboratory. Microfabrication is just making tiny things, right? Microfab. And we do thin film electrodes, we do microfluidics, and we do a number of other applications with a microscale vat photopolymerization printer. And all of that is going to be combined in our new renovated space. And that's when we're going to be looking at pulling in powder bed fusion of PEEK for its exactly those characteristics that you were talking about, Joris.
Yeah, that's cool. But I think that's interesting. I mean, I think also, but the issue, of course, is that with PEEK, the recyclability of the leftover powders is I think, I mean, this would be nice to say low. So especially if you're going to be printing just like one thing, right? It actually, like, the economics are really, really difficult, right?
Yeah. You guys have talked about economics a couple of times now, and I want to continue to say that the focus of Mayo Clinic and its primary value is that the needs of the patient come first. And by licensing out our inventions and commercializing them, we are recouping funds that help us to invest in new technologies and bring these new technologies to the fingertips of the physicians. So it is a give and take. We are overhead at Mayo Clinic, which means we're not expected to recoup any funds in what we do. There is an annual budget to which we stick, and that's why we have to plan so far in advance for those capital equipment items that we're looking to add to our repertoire. But yeah, there definitely the economics of PEEK and the recyclability of PEEK and the recyclability of resins and anything is important. And I do think that one of the fields that is a little bit lagging, one of the parts of the field that is lagging in additive is looking at recyclability and green applications. So it is a focus. We have waste champions at Mayo Clinic. So people who are trained in making sure that we are recycling as much as possible, that we are not wasting. And that's where additive really shines too, right? Because we're not using traditional manufacturing methods every single time. You're not taking a hunk of metal or a hulk of plastic and whittling it down and wasting all those extra chips. You are utilizing what you need to build the part layer by layer, and then ideally recycling as much as possible to go into the next build. So I think additive really shines in the medical space versus some of the other traditional manufacturing methods.
Yeah, I think, yeah, no, I agree with you totally. But I think, yeah, specifically with PEEK, of course, you can't really reuse any of the other powder. So it kind of becomes super expensive because it's such an expensive kind of powder to support your part.
Relatively, so, right? It's all relative. Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, a CT scanner is, you know, tens of millions of dollars. And if we spend $27 on a PEEK build, no one's blinking an eye.
Okay. All right. Okay. And then another thing I'm really excited about, because you guys are working this, like, okay, now you've got all these different materials, super nice that the materials are exploding, but then the sterilization, there's different sterilization methods, there's different surgeries. Mm-hmm. Now you have to get all this stuff sterilized. You pointed that out before. That's also very difficult. Tain changes material properties sometimes. Some materials can't be sterilized with certain processes.
Yep. And so it's really important to leverage ISO 10993, which is the biocompatibility international standard, and understanding your use case and how deep into the body the part is going. Is it just skin contact? Is it mucosal contact? Is it airway contact? Or is it all the way into the bloodstream? There are different tests that need to be done in order to validate that the part and the geometry that you've selected, or a range of geometries similar to what you've selected, can be made biocompatible. So what you do is you figure out the worst case geometry, the tightest hole for the screw, the tightest tolerance for the bone saw, the tightest, you know, the smallest acute angles where biologics can infest, I guess. So you don't want your viral cells or your bacterial cells to live after cleaning and sterilization. And so you leverage third-party testing companies that can do testing like cytotoxicity, irritation and sensitization testing, to name a few, that can validate for you that if you print in a geometry similar to what you've presented us, and you clean it and sterilize it as you say you are going to, you are effectively removing all of those nefarious cells. And that's what we do. We send out our parts for third-party validation.
Okay, that's super cool. And then and we didn't really touch a lot about like the software thing. Is there something lacking on the software? Or are you kind of really happy, like, oh my God, I have everything I need? Or are you really like, oh my God, I wish that would be developed?
Because everyone loves the software.
Yeah, yeah. No, we don't have everything we need, right? We have siloed structure when it comes to software. So you use one software for radiological imaging segmentation. You'd use a totally different software for computer-aided design. You use another software for slicing and deriving what is mostly known as G-code or whatever's going to feed into the printer. And then there's the printer driving software. And then there's any software that you need to run for post-processing or machining of the part. None of those talk to each other. And what we found is useful is incorporating a manufacturing execution system to help with at least tracking the status of each of those steps and confirming the parameters that were used all the way through the process. So I'm a huge fan of the manufacturing execution systems that are on the market right now. They are extremely customizable, but that also comes with its own headache because what that means is that the user or the customer has the responsibility to fully customize the system, and that takes a lot of time and a lot of understanding of the infrastructure of the software. So, you know, manufacturing execution systems are great, especially when they can connect to the printers and tell you, okay, printer A is printing right now, the door is locked, here's the part that it's printing, here's a little thumbnail of what that looks like, and here's how much the material is going to cost. Here is how much is support versus how much is model. And there's a ton of data that are collected throughout manufacturing execution system if it's connected to printers. But you don't have it interfacing with the segmentation software or the design software or the slicing software at this time. You have to manually upload those files if you want to keep your design history record up to date. So that's a big gap.
Are you finding that the design, like the CAD aspect of things, is the biggest bottleneck in the process in terms of getting to a finished product? Or is there something else that's actually the bigger bottleneck?
You know, printer reliability is a problem. Reliability is a problem. Right?
You don't say.
If we want to get to that stretch goal of a 5-day turnaround, we can't have our titanium printer go down. That just cannot happen. And so what you do is you control the equipment through IQ, OQ, and PQ, installation qualification, operational qualification, and performance qualification. And then you maintain the printer through daily, weekly, monthly, and yearly preventive maintenance. And that is all controlled in a system that tells you when to do it, what to do, who's done it, who's been trained to do it, how often are they trained to do it, and who's verifying that they're trained properly. So that is a huge part of controlling and coordinating the additive manufacturing facility. And Mr. Robbie Hyatt is our additive manufacturing facility coordinator, and he's just a rock star when it comes to controlling the equipment and keeping it as healthy as possible so that it can be used on demand.
Super cool, Amy. I think, I'm actually quite surprised how far you guys are. And I'm really, really happy you guys can talk about this stuff. And I'm really super enthused that you guys are pushing ahead with this.
Yeah, thank you. It's a lot of work, but we have a passionate team. You know, we have a quality management system that is over 10 years old, over 13 years old at this point, I think. And that helps us to maintain safety and efficacy of all of our processes from start to finish. I'm grateful for the opportunity to be here and talk to you guys today. Do you have any other questions?
No, that's fine. Amy, thank you so much for your time today with us.
Awesome. Thank you.
And thank you, Max, for being here as well.
Yeah, no. Thank you, George.
And thank you for listening. This is another episode of the 3D Pod.
You've been listening to the 3D Pod. For more information on what you just heard or to subscribe, visit www.3dprint.com or follow us at 3dprint_com.